The latest Medicaid shakeup could change the landscape of Illinois hospitals, especially safety net hospitals that serve low-income and uninsured people.
So we're sort of under the crunch of getting this agreement so that then we can get something passed in the General Assembly.
That's Representative Juliana Stratton speaking to WGN Radio about the urgency of funding hospitals. And we know police can use a breath test to see if you're drunk driving. But with more Americans dying from drug addiction, how does law enforcement figure out whether someone's driving while high? One suburban Chicago town is implementing some new measures on that front. Also, what do you think when I say prolapse or fissure? Are you shocked or uncomfortable?
For a lot of postpartum issues, there's this whisper net of women telling each other about, well, here's the stuff that might happen to you that nobody tells you anything about.
We talk about the things women and men don't talk about after childbirth. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to funding hospitals, it might be easy to assume that it comes from others' insurance bills and the high bills that we pay. But of course, the reality of that is much more complicated. And that's especially the case for our state's safety net hospitals, which serve low-income, uninsured, and vulnerable populations, according to the Illinois Hospital Association. As it stands now, nearly every hospital in Illinois has paid into a pot of money that helps the state bring in more federal Medicaid dollars. But now, state lawmakers, lobbyists, and Governor Rauner need to update the program, change how hospitals are assessed, and how funds get doled out. This has hospitals concerned, a number of lawmakers racing to make an agreement. A hearing about potential changes is scheduled in Chicago tomorrow. Kristen Schorsch has been covering this for Crane Chicago Business. She joins us from Chicago. Also joining us now is Jose Sanchez. He's CEO of one of the state's safety net hospitals, Norwegian American. Kristen, Jose, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for having me in the program.
Yeah, good morning. Jose, can you tell us about the patient population that Norwegian American serves?
Yes, we actually give you an overview. Three out of four patients that we see here have Medicaid coverage. We certainly see more than 300,000, more than 30,000 emergency room visits per year. Our inpatient utilization rate is really above 53%, one of the higher utilization rate among safety net hospitals.
Jose, can I ask you, can I stop you for a second and ask you, what is inpatient utilization rates? What does that mean?
It means how many patients do we see in the hospital, and what is the proportion between inpatient hospital admissions and those who are seen in the outpatient services.
I see. Okay.
Right.
And, okay. And, Kristen, is what Jose describing typical for safety net hospitals?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, most safety net hospitals, I mean, they're defined by having a high Medicaid population. They treat the most vulnerable people, people who are low income, people who are uninsured. There are 22 safety net hospitals in Illinois, and nearly half of them are on the south and west sides of Chicago.
Okay. And Jose, what funding sources does your hospital depend upon then? We've already talked about Medicaid. What else?
Well, I mean, the majority of the funding that we actually get is Medicaid. If we take a look at, the straight Medicaid patients is above like 53-55%. But if we combined, because there are patients that actually do have both Medicaid and Medicare, if you take a look at that population and we aggregate them both, it is about 79%. So that's basically, and any impact on the Medicaid program has a serious impact in our revenue stream in the hospital because of the high number of Medicaid patients that we see in our institution here.
Kristen, our listeners may recall that I know that Illinois gets one of the lowest rates of funding for Medicaid. Is that accurate when we first just look at the pot of Medicaid money for funding for these hospitals?
Right. They have Right. They have one of the lowest federal matches in the country. It's about 50%.
Wow. So how does it work, Kristen? I mentioned there's sort of this pot of money that every hospital in Illinois pays that helps the state bring in more federal Medicaid dollars. How does this assessment work?
Right. So it's essentially a tax on hospitals, and nearly all the hospitals in the state contribute into this. Illinois then takes this money to the federal government and they get a match. So this program generates about $3.5 billion for the Illinois Medicaid program. To show you how big of a deal it is, when you think about the budget for the state agency that runs Medicaid, this money makes up about 16% of it. So it would be a big hole in the state budget if we didn't have this money. The way the program works, and one of the reasons why lawmakers, hospital lobbyists, and the state want to update it is because it's dated and it doesn't exactly reflect how the healthcare industry has changed and where Medicaid patients are getting care. So essentially, hospitals pay into this pool based on how full their beds were in 2005 and what their outpatient revenue looked like in 2009.
Oh, wow. So that's a really long time ago.
Right. It's a long time ago. And then they get money back based on how much in Medicaid care they provided in those years. But a lot has changed since then. You think about the fact that across the country, hospitals are emptying out. They have fewer patients because there's this huge focus on prevention and outpatient care to keep people from getting sick in the first place. So you have fewer patients that need to be hospitalized. In Chicago in particular, we have population losses. So we're losing people, which means that hospitals are losing patients. And this has hit small hospitals on the south and west sides particularly hard. And then you have the Affordable Care Act. The state expanded the Medicaid program here under the ACA. So they added about 642,000 people, additional people in the Medicaid rolls. And so there have been a lot of things that have changed. And so that's part of the reason why everyone wants to modernize this program. Now, the trick is to figure out how do you balance it. And one state lawmaker told me, recognizing that this is obviously a really huge deal and controversial, that there are going to be winners and there are going to be losers as this kind of shakeup happens.
So, Kristen, help me understand this. You said, so essentially every hospital in Illinois sort of taxes themselves. They pay a tax in order to help provide care for the most needy throughout the state. Is that correct?
Right. They pay a tax. This program has been going on for a long time. It's been updated a few times, but right, they essentially pay a tax. The idea was that it was to help the Medicaid program leverage more money to go to the federal government so that we could get more money back because the federal government will match those state dollars.
And Kristen, is this how other states do it as well?
There are a lot of these types of programs across the country.
Okay. And so, Jose, I have a question for you. When you look at how your hospital has functioned, I'm not sure if you were there back in 2009. I imagine even your hospital, a safety net hospital, has a very different population it was serving in 2009 than it did in 2017.
Yeah, that's correct. I think that the situation is not unique to every hospital. For example, Norwegian American Hospital, when we take a look at 2009, yes, to 2015, which is some of the data that is being used basically to kind of evaluate the utilization of these institutions, actually, Norwegian American Hospital volume has increased.
So you're seeing seeing more patients now than you did.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I see a lot more patients today than back in 2009. But even today, 2018, or if we just take a look at 2017, from 2009 to 2017, we still see more. When they did the evaluation of the utilization of the safety net hospitals that are benefiting from the assessment dollars, actually they used data from 2015, which actually was not accurate, at least for some institutions, and we think that there were some flaws in the model that basically. At least HFS is beginning to kind of trying to develop to assess how these assessment dollars are going to be distributed for the hospitals that participate in the program.
And Jose, from your perspective, do you feel that the modernization, this is an update that's the current program set to expire on July 1st, it sounds like you also would like them to at least just even update the metrics by which they're basing this information on, because that would obviously make a difference for you in terms of the amount of funding that you would receive.
Yeah, well, there are several things that I would like to mention. I mean, I think certainly there is no question that the program needs to be modernized. There is no questions about that, and that needs to be updated. I guess is how you go about doing that. For example, putting those dollars into the rate, that doesn't really mean that there will be a predictable financial result for a number of hospitals. Our concern all along is to say to HFS, that is the Department of Healthcare and Family Services of the state, is to say to them, hey, you know, let's begin to put into the rate a small portion of those dollars so that to see how we transitioned from this old system to this new system. They want to be much more aggressive. We are asking for a longer period of time to transition totally into that new model of funding, and they are saying we want 2 to 3 years. And that is very risky because we don't know how quickly some of these hospitals are going to be able to transition to this new model. In addition to that, February, the Department of Healthcare and Family Services released a request for proposal to actually reduce the number of healthcare plans. You know, now we only have 7 participating healthcare plans. That in itself is really problematic because some of the issues that we have been bringing to the attention of the department regarding approval for services, settlements, credentialing, how do we settle denials, and payments timely has never been resolved.
Yeah, so it sounds
so
like that's also
changing,
right. So it sounds like that's adds a further layer of complexity to this as well, Jose. Kristen, can I ask you, as Jose's sort of outlining all of the things that are difficult with his hospital, and we're talking just obviously from his perspective of a safety net hospital, I wonder when we're thinking about what lawmakers are proposing for modernizing this. Kristen, what are they talking about?
Right. So in this proposed new program, and nothing is final, and I do want to mention, too, for your listeners, the public hearing for tomorrow has been canceled, and there's going to be one instead on January 18th.
Oh, thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, and it's scheduled for 10 a.m. at the Blandick Building in the Loop. They can go to ilga.gov, the General Assembly's website, to track that and find more details, but I just wanted to point that out.
Thanks for that. We'll tweet that out as well. Thank you, Kristen.
Sure. So then in the proposed new program, as of right now, they want more money to follow patients. And they also want, they would have hospitals pay into the pot of money and get money back based on 2015 data. So it would be updated. And the idea is to, like I mentioned before, you know, reflect how healthcare is actually being used by Medicaid patients today. So, I mean, the overarching goal is also to make the program more fair, I believe. But what some of the consequences could be is that hospitals that treat more Medicaid patients now than they did in, say, 2005 and 2009 will likely get more money, and then hospitals that don't will likely get less.
Right.
We still are you know, waiting to see how this is going to play out in terms of, you know, we know right now how much hospitals pay in and what they get back from the state, but in terms of how that's all going to look, what that's going to look like going forward after July 1, we still don't know yet. That's all still being negotiated. You know, some details have trickled out. I talked to the CEO of Roseland Community Hospital on the far south side the other day. He said now he pays in about $4 million into the pool and gets back about $23 million. That's roughly half of that hospital's budget. Under this new plan, at least the latest proposal, he said he would get about $7 million less. And like Jose mentioned, right, I mean, it's every dollar for safety nets is vital to their budgets. But at the same time, I did want to point out that, you know, because of the new realities of healthcare, one of the things that the state lawmakers and other people at this negotiating table are wanting to provide is a pot of money that hospitals could use to convert their facilities, recognizing that communities might not need a hospital anymore. Maybe they need an urgent care center instead, a behavioral health hospital. I mean, these are obviously big changes, but hospitals would be able to apply for this money and essentially change their business models. That's kind of a big component of this program going forward, too.
Right. And of course, Kristen, with all of this, Kristen and Jose, we haven't even mentioned how the elimination of the individual care mandate may affect all of that. So that's another big question I imagine hanging over this. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I want to thank Kristen Schorsch, who covers this. She's a healthcare reporter for Crane Chicago Business. As Kristen mentioned, the hearing has now been postponed for a week and a half from now. So we are, I believe, in next week. So we'll send out all of that information for folks who are interested in that. I want to thank Kristen as well as Jose Sanchez. He's the CEO of Norwegian American Hospital in Chicago. Both of you, thanks for being with me. Thanks for explaining a little bit more about this.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're a mom who's out there listening right now, then chances are you have experienced the joys of having a baby and bringing that little one home. But you might have also experienced a lot of other things that we don't talk about very publicly. Night sweats, tears, even bleeding. So when University of Illinois professor Kate Clancy, who studies reproductive health, among other things, started tweeting about this a week ago, she struck a chord with thousands who started sharing their postpartum stories. People are still responding to that thread that she wrote. Lots of think pieces I've seen online from different mom blogs talking about this as well. Professor Clancy works in the Department of Anthropology. She's also host of the Period podcast, and she's here with us in our Urbana studios. Hi, Kate. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when you started this thread, just sharing sort of your postpartum experiences after the birth of your second child, did you think you would get such an outpouring of support?
No. I mean, the reason that I started writing is it was after midnight. You know, as the first tweet says, it was, you know, in the middle of the night and I had horrible heartburn. In fact, I was convinced that I was dying at this point. I mean, it was so painful that I was pacing the halls in my in-laws' house while my husband and daughter are asleep in my husband's childhood bedroom. And I'm just pacing and furious and in so much pain. And so I finally, in a fit of not getting enough sleep and probably being slightly delirious from it, just started writing about my experience. So I didn't really think so much about the response so much as raising awareness.
Right. And so as Kate shares her story and lots of women have shared their story, I want to let people know they can give us a call as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. That's our Twitter handle. You haven't really, have you been open publicly before about sort of what your postpartum experiences have been like?
I had, certainly more so with this one than with my first child, but not always to the degree of gruesome detail that I think I was in this Twitter feed. I did tell people about the hemorrhaging that I experienced because it was, frankly, very scary. And I was very, very ill for the first several weeks because my iron was so low. I had word recall issues. I couldn't stand up without feeling like I was going to pass out. And it was just a terrifying several weeks in a lot of ways. And because I had these very high expectations of myself, despite all of my knowledge about this, that I was going to bounce right back. I was going to be meeting with students, back to lab meetings, back to work, just with infant in tow. I kept feeling like I had to explain myself. And so I kept explaining and telling my story, partly because of the memory loss of the lack of iron and partly because I really felt like people had to understand, no, I swear, I'd be back at work right now if I weren't, you know, practically dying.
Yeah. So I feel like we should probably say a kind of scientific graphic talk warning here before we start talking about everything. But I think let's start with the physical part of what you experienced and you shared. We'll have some real talk about what change happened to you and what you shared about. You talked about tears, hemorrhoids. What else?
So it started with the my baby had what's called shoulder dystocia. It just meant she was a big honking baby, and it's kind of hard to fit a big baby through a not big space. And so that meant that I tore. It often is associated with hemorrhage. So that's, you know, lots and lots of bleeding that can occur, often a dangerous amount of bleeding postpartum. And so those things kind of set off a cascade of other things happening. So when you hemorrhage that much, there's some concern that there's a little placenta left behind. And so they often, rightly so, doctors put you on antibiotics. So my midwives, with the advice of their doctors, had one form of antibiotics when I first gave birth and then another course just to be sure. And again, this came from a great place. But unfortunately, that's what led to me having all sorts of issues with my colon. So
yeah, antibiotics are really rough, right? I can't imagine the turmoil your body goes through after giving birth, but then throw antibiotics into the mix, even when folks are taking antibiotics for other, you know, nausea. Some people get, you know, people sometimes have really tough reactions to antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what seemed to happen all around the same time was getting C. diff and also having hemorrhoids and fissures, which, again, are in some ways mortifying to talk about. But at this point, I've said it so many times, I'm just like, well, people might as well know what's going on with me.
And that's the thing. Nobody wants to talk about anal tears, obviously. But why do you think do you think it's just because it's that area that nobody wants to talk about it? Or maybe it's something, you know, husbands know about, partners know about, but that's about it?
I think there's two things. I think one is, yeah, it's an embarrassing part of the body, right? It's one that we don't tend to talk about. And I think the other is that we don't recognize that, particularly in women, though this also certainly happens in men, you know, all of that plumbing is all kind of connected and all close to each other. So if you're going to end up with pelvic issues, which are in some ways almost guaranteed when you have a baby, you're going to have something going on down there just in terms of the normal adjustment of all your organs getting back into place. Then you're going to have issues with your rectum, your vulva and vagina, your urethra, you know, everything down there that is taking care of you is going to probably have some kind of effect from birth.
So, Kate, you're an anthropologist. Do you think that a lot of you expressed, and I want to ask you about the scientific research part of this later, but I wanted to start with sort of the cultural expectations of what you think we put around mothers in particular. And I think there is a lot of, I mean, I would say, I think it's certainly really positive that we talk about motherhood and childbirth and we talk about how beautiful it is. But do you think that there's probably a little more reality that we need to inject into the conversation as well?
I do. And I think there are a lot of people out there who have been trying to do this for some time. I mean, I think those of you, those folks who do write mommy blogs, who do write lifestyle blogs, who do share honestly about their lived experiences, have been doing this for some time. I think there's quite a bit, certainly around postpartum depression, that I think has done a lot to raise awareness. But I do feel like some of the physical issues have been harder to cover. There's this whole group of pelvic floor physical therapists that you can follow on Twitter with hashtag pelvic mafia. And they're folks who have been doing a lot to try to address issues of incontinence and prolapse for a long time. But, you know, aside from sort of that group, and again, sort of, I think folks who, as part of their profession, share their lives, there isn't really much out there.
And so you had women responding to you. You had thousands of people retweeting your thread and people responding. I even saw someone responding yesterday to you and people, women sharing their stories. And one woman saying she needed surgery to repair her prolapse. And she just kept thinking, why didn't anyone check her pelvic floor and send her to PT immediately? When I finally sought help on my own, the physical therapist said my pelvic floor was too weak for help. The medical system failed her. Do you think that's part of the problem as well in terms of care of mothers? Like, there's a lot of obviously focus on care of the infant. Do you think there's enough conversation about care of mothers postpartum, apart from depression, which I think is something that is part of the mainstream conversation now?
Certainly. I think, right, I don't think that we do enough for postpartum moms. I had despite my complications, I actually had really wonderful care and really wonderful midwives caring for me that I still have this deep love for, because I feel like we went through something big together and they took really good care of me. And what was wonderful is I actually had a home visit after I came home. But then after that, it's the normal care is a 6-week visit and then you're done. You kind of graduate from, you know, either obstetrics or midwifery after that. And a lot of things that emerge for women happen after the 6-week point. I've met so many people now who've had hemorrhoids, fissures, or prolapse all happen after the 12-week point, even mastitis after 10 months in some of the tweets that I saw. So people are really up against a lot of stuff happening, you know, later than that one checkup.
I'm speaking with University of Illinois professor Kate Clancy about her most recent, her sharing that she's done on social media. You also talked a lot about this in your period podcast. And so I think when it's a podcast, it sounds weird to say that it's an intimate thing in a podcast, but I think everyone's sort of used to people sharing intimate details in podcasts, and that reaches oftentimes a niche audience of people who are interested in that, right? So you can share sort of the gruesome details in that podcast and among that community, kind of like you're saying with the pelvic floor physical therapists, they have sort of their own communities. What do you think we need to do? I think you've sort of created a moment, certainly among a lot of people, to have this go into the mainstream more. What else do you think we need to do culturally to talk about this more?
Gosh, it's so hard to even think about where to start. I mean, one of the first places to start is thinking about the expectations we place on mothers in terms of, I mean, as a working mother, I'll start with thinking about working mothers and the fact that maternal leave is terrible for most people. I have a lot of family in the military, and the military are exempt from FMLA, so they don't even get, you know, the 12 weeks unpaid leave that are mandated.
Right. Or I think about women who work in service industry or other hourly jobs where there oftentimes are not sick leave at all, and other women who have to go back immediately.
Exactly. And, you know, while we might think that there are protections that keep people from being fired when they go on leave, the reality is that that happens to lots of people. You can even see in the Twitter stream, I think just the other day, someone talked about an experience that they had where they were encouraged to come back 1 week after having their baby because they were transitioning to a new job and that new place didn't want to, you know, be paying them for leave before they started working.
Right. So one thing is sort of changing the culture around expectations for working moms. What about from a research standpoint? You mentioned this in your thread, frustration about, obviously, there's lots of research on postpartum care for infants. What does the research fare in the medical community? What does research look like for postpartum care for moms from the physical standpoint? Again, not necessarily the emotional.
Mm-hmm. The one that I'm most familiar with is prolapse, just because I, as someone who is now experiencing it myself, but have had loved ones experience it, I spent a lot of time looking at the literature. And the number of interventions that exist are quite small. The degree to which they work are quite small. And so what it seems, and certainly just from talking to my own gynecologist recently, what it seems like most people are doing are just waiting for women to hit menopause for it to get bad enough to have surgery and then to just have surgery. And the surgery just sounds awful, something I would never want to do, which, though it seems like maybe that's in my future in another 20, 30 years. So, you know, certainly to me, one of the big things is the fact that, you know, the again, if it's okay for me to use some technical terms, the vaginal wall does get more relaxed. You know, it has to push out a baby and it weakens the walls. And that means that all sorts of organs can kind of fall in. And we don't know a lot about why so many women are so susceptible to it, but why some are not. And I think that that's, to me, a really important research direction. There are a lot of practitioners doing their best with the evidence that they have, but there's just not a lot out there.
Would you say that's reflective of research about women's health in general, that there's not enough scientific research going on? Or do you think this is a particularly bad or less researched issue?
Oh, I continually, as someone who does this work, I feel like I continually come up against this, where I'll either personally have an issue, a friend will have an issue and contact me, and I'll go to the literature and then I'll say, how is it that I can't find anything on this? Or I'll find a handful of papers, but they'll really be unsatisfactory in terms of the degree of rigor, you know, how much funding is clearly put towards it. I mean, just in my own research, you know, I study the menstrual cycle for a lot of what I do. And it's often appalling to me how few studies actually measure women every single day over a cycle in order to see what's going on with their hormones over time. And they'll do one or two measurements and say, that's about enough, you know, because I guess the hormones are expensive to study. But if you measure once in one half of the cycle and then you think that that characterizes an entire woman's experience, you know, it's not surprising then that, you know, we don't actually understand what the range of normal is.
And then I think so that's part of it. There's the research part of it. There's the culture part of it. And then I think there's the part that everyone, I think, especially when you're sort of a hardworking person, you know, one of the tweets in your thread said, I'm 100% sure I would not have had all these issues if I hadn't pushed myself so hard to get back to work. Some of this is on me and how I've internalized expectations in a masculinized workplace. Mm-hmm. So how much you've probably had a lot of time to think about that also in the past few months.
Certainly. You know, in my other line of work, and in fact, the last time I was here, we spoke about some of my work on sexual harassment in mm-hmm. scientific workplaces. And a lot of the reading and research that I've done in that area has shown that, you know, when you operate in a male dominated workplace, which unfortunately are still most workplaces, even when they're not 50% or more men, they still have a history of operating under, you know, sort of male-dominated culture.
Well, even if they're female-dominated, even if they're female-run, it might not make a difference because, I mean, at least in my experience, I've sort of found that sometimes different generations approach things differently. So you might have someone who's like, no one talks about this after a certain age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And I think part of it is that, you know, if you internalize this idea that you could think of as generational, that you could think of as because those earlier generations were probably more male dominated. And by that, I mean, you know, having different expectations of what you do in a workplace because you assume that there's someone at home taking care of everything else. So you can basically think of yourself as not having a body and just come to work and have your mind and do the work you're supposed to do and then go home and you can compartmentalize. When you acknowledge that you have not just a mind, but also a body, it gets a lot harder to leave your body at home every day and just assume someone else is going to take care of it. And I think for me, you know, even as someone who is a feminist, who tries to be thoughtful about these things with my colleagues and my students, I still was being so hard on myself and expecting myself to come back, even when my own students were like, Kate, it's okay, take a break. We don't have to meet yet. We don't have to have lab meeting yet. And I was like, no, we must do it. And I just really, I think it was my way of trying to feel normal again after having a child. But it also, again, was this way that I'd internalized that if I'm good at what I do, then I come back fast.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I wanted to ask you more about how other cultures handle this. I know you discussed this in your most recent podcast, so we'll have to leave the conversation at that, but we'll tweet out a link to your period podcast. If folks are more interested in that, they can follow us at 21STShow. But I want to thank Kate Clancy, who teaches, and she's an associate professor in anthropology at the University of Illinois, for talking to us about this. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We all know that if you get pulled over and an officer thinks that you are driving under the influence of alcohol, they can test that on the spot with a breathalyzer. But now police have another challenge. How can you tell if someone is driving under the influence of drugs? We've talked on The 21st before about the opioid crisis that faces not just Illinois, but the country. The number of Americans who are dying from drug addictions has been on the rise. The Governor's Highway Safety Association says that in 2015, there were more drivers in fatal crashes who tested positive for drugs than there were drivers who had alcohol in their system. States have taken different approaches to how they could handle it. Here in Illinois, the Carroll Stream Police Department in the west suburbs of Chicago is testing new ways to detect whether drugs are in a person's system. We wanted to learn a little bit about how this process is already at work in other states. I'm joined now by Officer Hannah Walcott with the Golden Gate Division of the California Highway Patrol. Also on the line is Kansas State Trooper Adam Hankins with Kansas Highway Patrol. Both of you, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Officer Walcott, let's start with you. If an officer in California pulls someone over, how do they figure out whether the driver is under the influence of drugs? What tools do they use right now?
Right now, we're using our standard field sobriety tests, which, you know, we can go into depth about those. But we have all of our officers trained on advanced roadside impaired driving enforcement, which means we're looking for more than just alcohol symptoms. So we're looking for pulse, you know, we're taking heart rates right there, you know, on scene. We're looking for things that go on with the eyes when you're impaired on drugs that are different than if you're impaired on alcohol. We go over the field sobriety test there on scene. And then once the officer determines that somebody's under the influence of drugs, then we take them in for a blood test.
And so that's the law in California. What does the law say in California about whether or not can you refuse a blood test in California if law enforcement has conducted a field sobriety test and determined that further testing is needed?
Yes, the person does have the option of refusing the test.
And what are the consequences of that?
That kind of depends on the county. So for example, here I worked in Alameda County, which is located in the Bay Area of Northern California. And in Alameda County, if you refuse the blood test, then the officer can go in and get a warrant and take forced blood from the person. So at that point, they cannot refuse once the warrant has been served.
And so that's a blood test to determine whether there are drugs within your system. Is that the way that California uses to determine whether or not someone's under the influence of drugs?
Yes, that's correct. That's the ultimate way, after the person has been placed under arrest. That is the chemical test that we use for drugs is blood.
And are there preliminary mouth swabs that are also done in California?
No, we don't do mouth swabs.
Trooper Hankins, I wonder if I could get you involved here. I know that you, in 2016, studied this issue with the goal of implementing similar legislation in Kansas. You worked on something called an oral fluids test. What's that, and how does that work?
Well, in Kansas, our legislature changed our preliminary breath testing statute to incorporate other bodily substances, which allows us to test for oral fluids. And we did that in 2011. In anticipation of Colorado and other states legalizing marijuana and the concerns with that. So as we progressed from 2011 and on, in 2015 into 16, our state conducted a scientific oral fluid study to basically establish the validity of oral fluids, which is not new and novel science. This stuff's been around since the 70s. And so we conducted our own study just to say that we did it. And so now in Kansas, we have the ability to test someone in a preliminary status, presumptively roadside, give them an oral fluids test that can give an officer kind of an idea what drugs are in their system other than alcohol. We currently do not have an evidentiary statute on that. We're trying to work with that with our legislature where we could use oral fluids as a replacement for blood testing, even though we know that blood testing is the golden standard. It truly is. It's hard to argue whether or not a drug is psychoactive in someone's system if it's circulating in their blood. However, oral fluids is proven to be, through science, a very close second place. It's better than urine, even though urine is not useless, and you cannot test someone's drug content with their breath. Alcohol is specific only in that case. Breath is only good for alcohol. So we have to find other viable options. So in Kansas, we did a study to help us get closer to that.
Trooper Hinkins, how often are you all seeing, I mentioned a statistic in the beginning from 2015 about drivers in fatal crashes being more often testing for drugs and alcohol. How big of a problem is this in Kansas? Are you seeing in the roads?
Well, it's a huge problem. I mean, we know statistically since 2007, fatal crashes have increased in this country dramatically. For the first time since 2007, we went over 37,000 fatal crashes in this country last year. And so in Kansas, our numbers have consistently gone up. We're a state of 2.9 million people. We just set another record in 2017 with 457 traffic fatalities. So our numbers are going up. That cannot be a coincidence that we are now a border state with a state that has legalization of marijuana. It's an impairing substance, regardless of what people's views are on that drug. It is still an impairing substance. And the only requirement that it puts on you to go purchase it from a store is the fact that you're over the age of 21, just like alcohol. So we've seen a spike in our fatal crashes, and so has every state in this country consistently for the past few years, give or take a couple here and there. So we've seen a rise in that, and we've also seen a rise in marijuana-impaired drivers. Just like Colorado may have not seen a large increase in fatal crashes, but they've seen a significant increase in fatal crashes that include marijuana-impaired drivers. So for us, our numbers are going up. We know in Kansas that central nervous system depressants, which is the category that alcohol falls under, is the number one category of impairment that we see across our state. But a close number two is now cannabis. And when it comes to drivers that have drugs, including cannabis in their system, so multiple drug categories in their system, that number is also going up. So we used to be able to say that, people would mask their alcohol consumption with perfumes or other sprays or other types of masking odors so people couldn't smell the alcohol. Now we're saying that people are consuming their drug use with the odor of alcohol. Someone's out there using pills, smoking marijuana, taking heroin, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
They are now masking their impairment with the odor of alcohol, knowing full well that an officer might stick a preliminary breath test in their mouth and they have a low BAC. However, they've got a really high drug impairment other than alcohol. So we're seeing it go up significantly.
Oh, dear. That's not a good combination. Officer Walcott, can I ask you about the blood testing, how long that takes and what that process looks like?
Yeah, sure. So once we receive the blood, we get two vials of blood and we send it off to a lab. It typically takes about 2 weeks at the most to get those results back. So in that meantime, the officer writes the report on their observations and why they think that person was impaired under whether it be alcohol or drugs. And then once they get the blood results back, that goes straight to the district attorney, and then they go from there.
That's Officer Hannah Walcott. She's a PIO with the Golden Gate Division of the California Highway Patrol. Officer, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're talking about this because the Carroll Stream Police Department in the west suburbs of Chicago is actually testing new ways to detect whether drugs are in a person's system. They declined our request for an interview to join us here on the 21st. But I'm joined now by Donald Ramsey. He's a defense attorney who specializes in under the influence law and a managing partner at Ramsell and Associates. Sorry, Don Ramsell. Welcome to the 21st, Don.
Hello, how are you?
Good morning. I understand you have some concerns about the law as it's being implemented in Illinois, or at least in Carroll Stream. What are your concerns as you've heard the officers sort of discuss how this has played out, first of all, in California, how they've tested it in Kansas?
Well, my concern primarily deals with the oral swab roadside test that the police are attempting to roll out and falsely claiming to be accurate ways of testing people to determine if they're under the influence of cannabis or other illicit drugs. Scientifically, the actual studies, not the police study in Kansas that was done by police officers, but actual studies performed in laboratories by scientists and published in peer-reviewed journals show that these drug-side oral swab tests are less than 50% accurate, and that's my greatest concern. For example, a recent study that was released in 2016 entitled A Study on the Reliability of On-Site Oral Fluid Drug Tests in a Recreational Context found that the type of test that Carol Stream is attempting to roll out failed both for sensitivity and accuracy, and held that the actual accuracy, when they took the same oral fluid and then tested it in a real laboratory setting, the accuracy of the testing was 29% accurate for cocaine, 53% accurate for opiates, and failed miserably for cannabis. Another study done in 2008.
Okay, well, it sounds like there's quite a few. Don, let me stop you there, because it sounds like quite a few studies that you have that all cast doubt as to the accuracy of this test. Officer Hinkins, can I ask you, are you familiar with the tests that are being used in Illinois, and to if you can discuss whether or not how accurate they are?
Well, I'm not thoroughly familiar with it. I did read an article, and I actually spoke at a conference in New Jersey last month and included mentioning Carol Stream because I knew they had started a program, oral fluid. And I believe they were using the Allaire DDS-2. I might be mistaken on that. That's what we used in Kansas. Our percentages were significantly better than that. And again, this is not new and novel science. This stuff's been around since the 70s. 15 states have some sort of oral fluids testing on their laws. Most European countries and other countries across this planet have switched to oral fluids as one of their primary abilities to evidentiarily test someone for impairment. So we're not jumping into a pool here head first with the blinders on and not knowing what we're doing. This stuff is a proven, legitimate science, and it gives us another tool in our tool bag to help us accurately determine impairment, especially roadside.
Right. Don, as you listen to Trooper Hinkins say that, I wonder how you legally would, from your perspective as someone who's a defense attorney in this issue, how you'd like to see police handling this. Because it's sort of, I guess, as Trooper Hinkins is saying, the need to obviously police people who are intoxicated or under the influence of drugs while they're driving and a danger to others versus, as you're saying, the accuracy of these tests.
Well, obviously, the attempt to take impaired drivers off the road is a good, valid service that the police should attempt to do. Where they fall short is when they try to use these cheap gimmicks for drug testing, these oral fluid testing. I understand that this officer said that these types of tests have been around since the 1970s. I agree. There's 40 years of research that says that oral fluids are not an appropriately valid method of testing. If you don't use laboratory gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, and you try to use these drug wipes, if you will, they fail. There's another study that's found in the therapeutic drug monitoring reported there, a collaborative effort between the United States and the European Union sponsored by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. It found that oral fluids tests were accurate 36% of the time for amphetamines, 35% for cocaine, 42% for opiates, and 7.7%
for cannabis. So, John, let me stop you there. Yeah,
cannabis.
And let me ask you then, we're almost out of time here. To your mind, does there exist tests on the market right now you think that are scientifically accurate? Is that just as a yes or no?
Gas chromatography and mass spectrometry is the gold standard. These attempts to use these roadside kits is a bad one and should be stopped immediately.
That's Don Ramsell with he's a defense attorney based in Illinois. I want to thank Don for offering his perspective. Thanks very much also to Trooper Adam Hinkins with Kansas Highway Patrol for explaining a little bit more about how Kansas has tried to implement this. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thank you, Nyla, very much. Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more past shows, as well as a little bit more background and information about what we're talking about on air. That gives us on our 21stshow.org website. You can find our Twitter and Facebook handles as well, where you can find out more information about what we're doing. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.